morning. This is the Third Degree, Environment and Social Justice Half Hour. I'm Jessica Minshall. On the show today, we're talking asbestos, conflicts of interest with the Environmental Authority's assessment of the James Price Point gas hub, and we head to Rio for the International Uranium Film Festival, the week after the Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit. First, we'll hear about the union push for a national asbestos authority to be established. Australia has one of the highest rates of asbestos-related disease anywhere in the world, but currently there's no national framework for managing asbestos. A federal asbestos management review is to be released later this week. Seeing this as a critical time, some trade union and asbestos activists were in Canberra this week, lobbying the federal government to establish a national asbestos authority. The Third Degree's Simon Unwin is speaking here with Paul Bastian, Acting National Secretary of the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union.
Paul, you're in Canberra today lobbying for a national authority on asbestos. Now, why is that needed? I mean, surely everybody's aware of the dangers of these materials by now.
Well, no, really the awareness levels of the problem with asbestos and how frequently you can find asbestos in Australian homes and buildings is not that well known. Two out of every three homes in Australia has asbestos in it. It's not labelled. People are not familiar with it. And what we're seeking today is to the asbestos management review report will be handed to government today. And we want to get down here early to say to the government that this is a unique opportunity here, a generational opportunity to actually do something positive to prevent exposures, unnecessary exposures to asbestos. Unfortunately, Australia has the highest rate of asbestos-related diseases in the world, and especially when it comes to mesothelioma. And this is a chance to finally deal with asbestos in situ, put some easy, quick remedies up so that we can reduce the exposure rate and the pain and suffering that comes with contracting asbestos-related diseases, particularly mesothelioma.
At the moment, asbestos issues are mostly dealt with by the states. Why isn't that enough?
Well, it's two reasons. One, the proliferation of asbestos throughout society, both in our housing stock and the commercial state. And secondly, the laws in relation to asbestos, whether it's to do with removal, disposal, or even, as you've raised before, public awareness, are absolutely all over the place around the country. And what we want to do is get one national authority that can advise the government and hopefully with COAG, the best methods for dealing with asbestos. What we're looking for is the national authority. We're looking for a prioritised removal program, particularly within public buildings. And in the domestic and commercial stock, we're seeking to get asbestos safety certificates. They become mandatory for any building built prior to 1987, which would identify whether the property contains asbestos, if so, where it's located, and the condition that's in. That way you can be assured that people will know that the building contains asbestos and they'll be advised on how to deal with that asbestos whenever they come in contact with it.
Yeah, certainly. It's interesting. We've been following certain asbestos issues on our show. And yeah, there's definitely in New South Wales, there's a few places where, you know, things have really fallen between the cracks. The New South Wales Ombudsman put out a report last year about a couple of different places. You know, there's a couple of communities on the south coast where the local council has been quite lax in the way that it deals with asbestos issues there. And also near my hometown in northwest New South Wales, there's a fairly large asbestos mine that the site hasn't been rehabilitated since the mine closed in the 80s.
That's why you need some national coordination. But the other thing you rightly identified is that you can't deal with asbestos in terms of lifting awareness unless you know where it is. That's why you need some form of national audit. Now, in the public sector, governments, state governments and federal governments actually know where asbestos is in their buildings. Most of those have audits already completed. So it's a matter of identifying it and having a prioritised removal program dealing with hospitals and schools and so forth. In the public sector, it proliferates. So it's not as simple to say that we want it all removed by 2030. But what we can do is introduce a process through those asbestos safety certificates that actually audit all buildings and homes built prior to 1987 as a mandatory requirement to have an asbestos safety certificate at point of sale, lease or redevelopment. That way, people will know that the building contains asbestos, where that asbestos is located and how they should deal with it if they want to renovate or make some changes to their place.
Paul, with the federal government making a lot of cutbacks to public spending, you know, with the efficiency dividend and so on, are you hopeful that they'll actually be able to find the money to fund a National Asbestos Authority?
Well, the federal government instigated this inquiry back in 2010. It was an initiative of the Prime Minister herself, Julia Gillard, and we're very helpful, having spent that time and money to bring in a group of experts to put together a report that the government will actually act on that report. Because as we said earlier, this is about saving lives. This is about preventing unnecessary exposure. There is no reason why we could not cut back those expected 40,000 exposures over the next two or three decades dramatically by making some simple little changes in terms of regulations and having a national coordinated approach.
Paul Bastian from the AMWU, speaking there with the third degree Simon Unwin. Someone else who travelled to Canberra to lobby for a National Asbestos Authority is Serafina Salucci. Serafina is a mother of four from Loftus in South Sydney. She's living with mesothelioma, a disease caused by exposure to asbestos. She told her story to the third degree.
I was diagnosed 5 years ago, and at the time I was 37. I'm married, I have four kids. At the time when I was diagnosed, my kids were 10, 8, 6 and 3. So I had very little kids at the time. They're not that much older now, obviously. And it was just a complete and utter shock. It came out of nowhere. I had a cough. That was the only symptom at the time. This persistent cough that wouldn't go away. And that's what actually took me to the GP. And it sort of went from there. I had tests and eventually had a biopsy. And I was diagnosed with mesothelioma. And at the time, I hadn't even heard of mesothelioma. I didn't know what it was. And I asked a specialist at the time, you know, what's that? And he said to me, it's an asbestos-related cancer. It's incurable and you'll never be rid of it. And after that, I did some chemotherapy. I had an operation where I had my right lung removed. And then I did some radiotherapy. And I was doing quite well for a couple of years. And then I had a reoccurrence. They found another tumour during one of my routine scans. And I had that removed along with a few ribs. That was a bit over a year ago, so I'm doing quite well now. But it's been really, really tough to be here.
At what point do you think, have you narrowed down where you might have been exposed to an asbestos-containing material?
Well, because the latency period is so long with mesothelioma, from the time you're exposed to the time that symptoms occur, I've read that can be anywhere between 10 to 50 years. So I was 37 years old when I was diagnosed, which basically means it could have quite easily occurred when I was quite young. When I was 7 years old, my father, this is the earliest memory that I have, when I was 7 years old, my father built a fibro garage in the backyard, and he did that on weekends because he was working Monday to Friday and he was just building himself. And my brothers and I were playing in the backyard. This was in the late 1970s, so it was during the time when people didn't know that asbestos was dangerous. My father certainly didn't know. And we were just in the backyard playing. And I remember, you know, my brothers and I picking up bits of offcuts from the fryboro and flicking it and throwing it around. And, yeah, we came into contact with it. And then growing up, there was a lot of fibro around, you know, in another house that we lived. There was the shed, the garage, and the laundry was made of fibro. And once again, we played in the garage, and we broke bits of fibro off the wall. And it was quite an old garage, so it was cracking and falling apart. So yeah, I've never actually worked with asbestos. I've never renovated, but I've certainly been around fibro, and that's obviously where I picked it up.
Wow, I mean, and that really does bring it home why this kind of regulation and awareness is needed, because, you know, we sort of tend to think of mesothelioma as a disease that's, you know, contracted by, you know, people who worked at Wittenoom, you know, in the blue asbestos mines in Western Australia. But it's not necessarily restricted to those people.
Yeah, That's right. And I'm an example of that. And that's why I'm here today, because they're predicting that down the track, more and more women are going to be diagnosed with mesothelioma, and they're predicting that people are going to be younger. So up until now, I've probably been an unusual case out of the ordinary in some respects, but I'm probably, unfortunately, representing, you know, the people that are going to be diagnosed down the track.
Yeah.
Which is a really, really sad statistic, I think.
Why is it so important that this is a problem that's dealt with nationally, do you think?
Because mesothelioma in particular is termed an incurable disease. It's fatal. The statistics and the facts and the history on it are quite appalling. The majority of people that are diagnosed with mesothelioma die within 2 years, and 5 years is considered long-term survival. So the statistics are not good, and it's incurable. As of today, there is no medical cure for it. So really, the only way we can deal with mesothelioma in the first place is for people just to be careful and prevent the disease being, you know, from people contracting that disease in the first place. But unfortunately, once you are diagnosed with mesothelioma, it's a very, very, very difficult situation.
So what would be the final outcome, you know, the long-term goal that you'd be looking for if this authority can be established?
Basically, to save people's lives, that's what it comes down to. They're predicting that the rate of people being diagnosed with mesothelioma, they are predicting that it's going to increase over the next 10 to 20 years. And as Paul said earlier, there's no reason why those figures, you know, can't come down. It can be prevented as long as people are aware and people are responsible and sensible. And know what they're dealing with, it can be prevented. So hopefully that these awful numbers and statistics that are being predicted hopefully won't occur.
Yeah.
You know, in the past, we didn't know that asbestos was dangerous. Once upon a time, that was the case, but we know now, and there's no reason why something shouldn't be put in place where people, as I said, are more aware and are more responsible and can manage or remove asbestos more responsibly. And put people less at risk, basically.
That's Serafina Salucci, who suffers mesothelioma, speaking with the Third Degree's Simon Unwin. Woodside Petroleum's proposed large-scale gas hub at James Price Point near Broome has long been a controversial project. We've covered the legal challenges and strong community opposition on this show before. Now, the project is subject to concerns over how its environmental assessment has been determined. Western Australia's Environmental Authority, the EPA, is expected to hand down the report into their assessment of this project on Friday. But it has been prepared by the chairman of the board alone, with the four other members removed from the decision due to conflicts of interest.
It's unprecedented. Absolutely unprecedented.
Peter Robertson is Western Australia coordinator with the Wilderness Society. What's unprecedented is the way in which the Environmental Protection Authority has had to remove four of its five board members from being involved in the environmental assessment of Woodside Petroleum's gas hub at James Price Point.
Four of them have now been ruled out of participating in this decision because of conflicts of interest. One person works for BP, which is a company that's involved in a possible project that would be part of this gas hub. Another member of the EPA formerly worked for the Department of State Development, which is the proponent of this project, and that person actually worked on this project in that department. And the other two members have conflicts of interest in relation to share portfolios, as we understand it. So you're left with one person, which is the chairman of the board.
Has there been further information about at what stage their involvement in the environmental assessment was halted?
Yes, information is gradually coming out. Elizabeth Carr, the one from the Department of State Development that I referred to earlier, she was sidelined at the moment that she was appointed about a year ago or something like that, because we uncovered the fact that she had previously worked for the Department of State Development. The minister never disclosed that when he made the announcement that she was going to be appointed to the board. And then much more recently, apparently only in the last 4 months, in fact, the other three members of the board, other than the chairman, have also been told or have decided that they can't participate either.
Peter Robertson is concerned that an assessment made by one person would not have received the full weight of an ordinary investigation by the EPA, as well as the lack of prompt public disclosure.
Why is it that the government appoints people to the independent board of the Environment Protection Authority that it knows full well, even although it doesn't necessarily tell the public, are likely to have conflicts of interest over any number of projects that end up being referred for assessment?
Robertson sees this as throwing into doubt the entire four-year assessment process.
As far as we're concerned, the government has got no alternative other than to appoint a new five-person panel to carry out this assessment and make its decision and recommendations to the minister.
The EPA's report on the project will be handed down on Friday, and next week there will be another legal case to be heard in the Supreme Court about the proposed gas hub. Josie Walker is Principal Solicitor with the Environmental Defenders Office in WA. She's representing Goolaburu traditional owner Richard Hunter in his challenge to preliminary works underway by Woodside at James Price Point.
Woodside was approved to do some site investigation works, which included soil testing and shallow drilling, also to do some deep drilling to extract water from the aquifer. And they got approved to put some temporary workers' accommodation there and also to put a helipad in.
They're challenging the process that allowed these preliminary works to begin. Separately to the EPA, this work was approved by the Kimberley Joint Development Assessment Panel, and Josie Walker will contend that this was done without proper process as to the information provided by Broome Shire Council. Walker is also hoping that the EPA report will offer an opportunity to reopen sites other than James Price Point for consideration of the location for the gas hub.
Well, the assessment is designed to look at what's the correct place or the best place for this processing to occur. We've been quite disappointed in the process because it seems to have gone away from that and gone more towards just looking at James Price Point specifically and not the full range of options.
That's Josie Walker, Principal Solicitor with the Environmental Defenders Office, ending that report. Last week, the Rio+ 20 Earth Summit was held in Brazil, as was its side conference, the People's Summit for Social and Environmental Justice in Defence of the Commons. The official talks, held 20 years after the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio, had the goals of planning for green economies, strengthening global environmental governance, and for countries to commit to new sustainable development goals. The Earth Summit document, titled The Future We Want, has been strongly criticised by environmental groups for its lack of substance. However, this weekend, the city of Rio, flooded by dignitaries and civil society groups and people from all over the world, will also host the second International Uranium Film Festival. And an Australian short film about the Maralinga nuclear tests, titled Maralinga Pieces, will premiere at the festival. Photomedia artist and videographer Jessie Boylan directed the film, and she's speaking here with The Third Degree. Your film Maralinga Pieces will be premiering at the International Uranium Film Festival in Rio this weekend.
Yeah.
But you won't be in the audience.
No, unfortunately, I guess it's a bit hard to get funding for films that, get produced in kind of a short amount of time in terms of getting over to the film festival run. But I also have some work in a Atomic Photographers Guild exhibition, and there is someone representing that big group of people, so that's pretty good.
So that's as part of that festival or alongside it?
Yeah, as part of the same festival, the big photographic exhibition that will also be at the Rio Museum of Modern Art, where all the films will be shown. But I would have loved to have got over there myself, especially at this time during, the Rio Climate Conference and everything.
And how do you describe your film, Maralinga Pieces?
Well, it's kind of in between a documentary and a video art piece, or we like to think that it's in between a documentary and a video art piece, trying not to lean too much on the documentary traditions of storytelling in terms of, giving a lot away or giving a lot of information. I think, there's been a lot of films about the atomic tests in Australia and a lot of documentaries about them, which sort of say factually what happened. But this is more leaning to kind of, the ongoing impact that these tests have had on Indigenous people and veterans who are also participating in those tests. And it kind of just, you know, is a bit of a cinematic journey through Maralinga and through some of the voices of people who've been impacted by those tests.
You filmed the material and interviews with traditional owners on uranium country in South Australia last year. And that certainly wasn't your first trip to the Maralinga nuclear testing fallout area in the desert.
Well, it wasn't my first. It was my first trip to actually the Maralinga Characha area and the lands where those atomic tests happened. I had travelled several times out to areas near there, like Wallatina Station, where a friend of mine, Yami Lester, was blinded by the atomic tests in the 50s. But he wasn't actually on those Maralinga Characha lands. So that was my first time actually getting out to their testing sites and to the Maralinga village, because it takes quite a while to get permit from Maralinga Characha Nation, because it's, you know, it's contaminated land still in some areas, and it's kind of, it's out of bounds, and, you know, you really have to have a good reason to want to go there, I think.
Was that contamination aspect a concern for you while making that film?
Definitely. I kind of, you know, we had a Gaga counter with us, and I was with an atomic veteran, obviously one of the people that I filmed there, Avon Hudson, and he was sort of, you know, I'm not going to take you anywhere that's dangerous, and another colleague of mine was, you know, using the Gaga counter everywhere. So I think we went to quite a few of the cleaned up sites, if you could say it like that. But, you know, I still had it at the back of my mind. The wind was very strong. You know, we were on the forward area, which is actually where the test sites happened. And, you know, I don't know. I don't entirely trust it, but I'm trying not to think too much about that.
So you'd visited areas around the main spot where the Maralinga test had taken place. But is the actual fallout area a place that you'd been wanting to go for some time?
I mean, yeah, I wanted to make a video about it, more of a video art piece than a documentary, and so this kind of fell more into the documentary style. And I'm currently, you know, doing a larger, longer-term body of photographic work or installation work, which is photographic, audio, archives, testimony, a lot of that kind of thing. So this is more, it was more of a, yeah, I've really been interested in seeing those spaces, because in Australia there aren't really that many sort of the artists that are actually dealing with issues of atomic testing in Australia. In the United States and in Chernobyl and the Ukraine, there's lots of people that are focusing on these issues, but in Australia it's kind of untouched in some way, and I think it's such a huge issue, and it's such a, you know, huge part of our history that's been so secret in so many ways, that I've been really interested in seeing the actual space, you know, that those tests happened, and just to try and get an understanding of the feeling of that land.
So about that actual space, you said that this is more of a video art piece. What images from that desert landscape really capture the long ago horrors of the nuclear testing history for you?
I guess some of the, there's, you know, at every ground zero spot where a blast happened, there's a plinth that's there that says, you know, this Taranaki, this bomb was detonated on such and such in 1957, and it was a yield of, you know, 15 kilotons, or, you know, this area or areas around here will remain radioactive. You know, that kind of, it's got a plinth there, and it's got a plinth somewhere else, like, few kilometres away or 20 kilometres away, where another test was detonated. And so I think some of those plinths, even though it's like, you know, it's amongst kind of seemingly normal landscape, it kind of gives you this eerie feeling of those blasts. And when you go back and you look at that footage from old footage, you know, it's like, well, shit, that's actually where it happened. And, you know, that huge impact that it had, the fallout on Indigenous communities and the impacts on veterans' lives that's been going on ever since then, it kind of, you know, comes down to this, you know, sort of, I guess it's, you know, it's a physical manifestation of what was, but it's also kind of like it's got so many more meanings to it, I think.
There are 48 films in this festival, now it's in its second year, including others from Australia. How important do you think it is for Australia's nuclear history and the uranium industry to be front and centre in this international scene?
Well, I think, you know, it's incredibly important. We've been fueling, you know, things like Fukushima. All of Australia's uranium was in Japanese nuclear power plants. and is still being sent, you know, overseas to other power plants. And, you know, our uranium, we're trying to build the largest uranium mine in the world, the largest open-cut mine in the world at Roxby Downs. And actually, there's quite a few films from Australia, David Bradbury, and quite a few other films from Australia, which is great because, you know, this is a place that's kind of always a little bit off the map in terms of what happens here and what we contribute to, and how we actually influence what goes on with our, you know, with our rich minerals and our export and what happens to Indigenous people here. I think it's always a little bit on the undercurrent. It's not so much seen as it as well elsewhere in the world.
And how do you think the Australian desert landscape around Maralinga will be viewed by the audience in Rio?
I mean, I guess a lot of the spaces still, they kind of look empty and they look desolate a little bit and they look like, okay, well, it looks far away. You know, how did it actually impact people? And I think that's some of the questions that I want to raise is that I'm not trying to tell people exactly, you know, this is what happened and that's what happened and this person was blind and that person was bar. It's more kind of like, you know, this has happened here and it's also been happening all around the world in Polynesia, in you know, the French atomic tests in the Pacific and in Northwest Africa and, you know, elsewhere in the world it's been happening, and the Indigenous people are usually the ones that have been impacted by it. And I think it kind of, I just want it to play into, you know, the greater world, you know, the kind of history that's part of more than just Australia and more than just elsewhere in the world.
Will your film also be travelling with the festival to Germany and India?
Yeah, I believe so.
And when will it be screening in Australia?
To be confirmed. We've applied for a few festivals that we're waiting to hear back from, so we'll definitely keep you up to date with that.
And that's Maralinga Pieces director, Jessie Boylan, speaking there. This has been the Third Degree Environmental and Social Justice Half Hour on 2SER. I'm Jessica Minchell. Before we go, however, from all of the team, I'd like to say a giant thank you to someone who has been instrumental to this program. Staff member Mark Robinson has left the station this week. Since the Third Degree moved to 2SER in 2008, Mark has provided invaluable encouragement and support, and we're very sorry to see him go. Thank you.